Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys. Welcome to the show. I'm Ed Ayers, here with fellow history people, Brian Ballow.
Hey there.
And Peter Onuf.
Hey, Ed.
Daniel Blake Smith was early in his career as a screenwriter when he decided to make a history movie. This was in the late 1990s.
We had funding to write a feature film about this signal event that took place in North Carolina, the 1960 lunch counter sit-in at Woolworth's in Greensboro.
It's an iconic moment in civil rights history. You might remember those pictures of four black college students peacefully protesting segregation and having food and drinks poured on them.
I felt I was in a good position to dramatize this story.
And that's because Daniel Blake Smith had something else going for him.
I was formerly an historian and a professor of American history at the University of Kentucky.
Smith had spent many years wading through the historical record and attempting to represent accurately what he found there. On the side, he had been writing historically based plays and documentaries. After interviewing the three surviving members of the Greensboro Four, he got down to writing. And he soon found himself asking an odd set of questions about each scene.
It's what I call the did it, could it, should it set of questions.
The first question is pretty basic. Did it happen? In this case,
did the four guys have dorm room bull sessions in which they ginned up their courage to talk about whether it should be doing this or not? You know, other people validated that, and I know for a fact that that's where much of it took place. So that was a clear did it question. It's documentable.
But what if he couldn't answer the did it happen question?
Then you move up to could it. And, you know, by that I mean, even if a particular moment was not verifiable from the historical record, was it at least genuinely representative of events that often did take place in similar contexts?
If the answer was yes, then into the script it went.
For example, one of the scenes involved one of the guys having an encounter outside a clothing store with a member of the Ku Klux Klan. That scene did not happen, but in fact, it did happen to their friends and other people they knew.
So that's could it. But then came the scariest question, one that he dreaded having to ask. Should it have happened?
I guess some would say this is where, for dramatic purposes, you know, you just need a particular moment to happen, regardless of whether it did or even could have happened.
Daniel Blake Smith says that he didn't invoke the dreaded should it question in this particular script, but he has done it since. Sometimes he says it's just necessary if you want to make the past come alive.
If by constructing that scene, it takes the audience to a place of emotional truth about a character or an event or a story, then I feel like it can be justified.
In the end, the movie about the Greensboro Four didn't get made, but Smith was proud of his script. And eventually, he did manage to find a home for the story within a somewhat safer genre, the historical documentary.
Did it? Could it? Should it? There are questions that we as historians think a lot about when we watch movies about the past. And this past year, there were a lot of those movies. Six of the nine Best Picture nominees were based on true events from the past.
And so today on the show, we're zooming in on a few of this year's Oscar-nominated movies, and we're going to reflect on the ways that they represent history. We'll examine the backstory of the book that 12 Years a Slave is based on, and we're going to consider the enduring appeal of the swindler genre, as represented this year by American Hustle and Wolf of Wall Street.
But we're going to start with another movie depicting recent events, and that's Captain Phillips. This is the Tom Hanks vehicle that tells the story of the hijacking of a massive cargo ship by four skinny Somali pirates. The pirates are forced off the ship, but they take the captain with them in a small lifeboat and try to ransom him for money. The setting may be exotic, but for at least one viewer, the story is very familiar. Christina Bross teaches English at Purdue University. When she saw Captain Phillips, she immediately recognized it as a captivity narrative. A first-hand account, that is, of a person's ordeal as prisoner of hostile forces and of that person's eventual return to freedom.
you can find captivity narratives in the Bible. You can find captivity narratives in classical literature, of course. But the Americans kind of put their own spin on it in the 17th century. And the text that those of us who teach English literature think about is Mary Rowlandson's Captivity Narrative, which was published in 1682.
Yeah, give us the setting now. And who was Mary Rowlandson and what happened to the poor woman?
So Mary Rowlandson is the wife of the minister, the English minister, at Lancaster in New England.
Mm-hmm.
War breaks out between the English colonists and an allied group of Algonquian peoples, and the English eventually call this King Philip's War.
Yeah.
And Rowlandson is in a garrison house because the war has not been good to the English. They are really been pushed back on their heels, and the house is captured. Her youngest, Sarah, is 6 years old. She's in her mother's arms when her mother runs out of the house. It's been set on fire. And they're both shot together. One bullet passes through Sarah and into Mary Rowlandson's side. She carries her daughter for 9 days or so before her daughter dies. She herself is wounded, of course, has to grapple with that. And then she's traveling. It's February in New England. And she's traveling with these folks cross country. And it's a time of famine. And she ends up traveling with her captors for about 3 months, 11 weeks before she's ransomed and brought home.
So this would be a classic story of, forgive the modern phrase, cultural encounter with the other, with different people.
And we get the same thing in Captain Phillips,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly, yes.
What I find fascinating about the captivity narrative in the 17th century, and I saw it again when I watched Captain Phillips, is we're in no suspense about the plot.
Yeah, so why are we watching this thing?
Exactly. Why do we pick up a book that on the title says we're going to hear the captivity and the restoration of
Boring.
This woman's?
Yeah.
Why are we going to watch a film where we all, you know, if we were awake in 2009, you know exactly what happened?
Yep.
I think the drama in here is in watching the individual struggle and trying to figure out what choices enabled survival.
Mm.
And I think the other, in the case of cultural encounter narratives, is we are looking for that interaction. Does the protagonist and his captors or her captors find points of contact or not?
So, Chris, the big takeaway from this story, which was so popular for so many generations, is that, oh, now we understand Indians better? What's the result of this intimate encounter with the other?
For Rowlandson, it's a real hatred after the fact of Indians she sees walking the streets in peacetime. She never regains her trust, and she really singles them out in her narrative.
So in some ways, this is one of the sources of Indian hating.
I think it is. I think it at least reflects a moment where there's a change in colonial policy from what had been before the war, a kind of cautious coexistence or a Christian approval of mission and evangelism, to after the war, really a policy of extermination.
Mm-hmm. So Captain Phillips is obviously a guy, and so he's experiencing his captivity and reacting to it in a different way than Mary Rowlandson, who's degraded as a woman, who finds herself in this as horrible situation. For her, it changes everything in a way. But Captain Phillips, he's a tough guy. He's supposed to deal with danger and risk.
Yeah, I think that is a particularly telling contrast, and actually I think maps onto the long history of the captivity narrative as a literary genre. Rowlandson, as the urtext, I might not call it degraded as a woman. She's negotiating different gender hierarchies, one of which requires that she be passive and wait for rescue, either by her husband who's negotiating ransom, or more profoundly, and the reason for her publication is that she's supposed to be waiting for God's salvation. And she says repeatedly, I'll wait on the Lord. I'll wait on the Lord. I don't think we can have that for Captain Phillips.
No.
And we're not going to have that in the intervening years with captivity narratives that have men at their center.
Yeah.
And so we see Phillips, again, I think, trying to outwit his captors and even attempting that escape. He jumps off the lifeboat and tries to swim.
So, Chris, let's step back and help us look at the big picture. How do we get from Mary Rowlandson to Captain Phillips?
So, particularly with Mary Rowlandson, as her story continues to be published and republished, the kind of Christian context tends to be de-emphasized. It's fascinating to look at the title pages of her narrative over time. And when you get to the 18th century, close to the Revolution, and they're publishing her story again, the picture on the cover is a picture of a woman with a rifle holding off her attackers. Yeah. So
you
we want to have,
right.
Yes, exactly. We want to have some heroism by the time we get to the 18th century. And the 18th century in general is going to shift treating captivity. The cultural encounter is no longer going to be just between, say, Europeans and Indians. It's going to shift, and we're going to see encounter between redcoats and patriots.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're going to see encounters between U.S. citizens in the New Republic and pirates off the Barbary Coast.
Barbary pirates, yeah.
Right. And we're going to have thematized then freedom, liberty. And we're going to see those themes kind of work their way actually into fiction. One of the things I do when I string together a bunch of captivity narratives to look at is I try to end with something that doesn't seem like a captivity narrative at all, which is maybe why I like Captain Phillips in this mix. And I look at 18th century fiction by women, where they're talking about marriage as a kind of captivity.
Whoa, that's getting very heavy, Chris.
Very heavy, right.
But
I think it shows how flexible the form is.
Yeah, very, very interesting. So how about slave narratives? There's another great movie in the mix this year, is 12 Years a Slave.
Right.
Does that fit into your genre?
I think so. And I think I like to think about, if we start with Rowlandson, a sort of family tree of literature. And one of the branches is, you know, I said I'm going to go to women's fiction, but another, and maybe the most important, is the branch that leads into the slave narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have, a long and rich tradition of works written by and about enslaved people. As I come forward to Captain Phillips, you know, it's all well and good to see these kind of literary tropes connect, but what does that add up to?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I was struck by with Captain Phillips, and maybe with a couple of other films that are coming through this year that are about survival, and I'm thinking about Gravity,
mm-hmm.
and I'm thinking about All Is Lost,
right,
is that these aren't taking place in national contexts. These are taking place in international waters.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you think about Gravity, up there with international space stations. And it seems to me that the notion of freedom here is being grappled with in a post-national maybe way.
Yeah, this is weird. Globalizing.
Yeah.
I think of the whole human rights revolution, that we're focusing on the integrity and the sovereignty of the individual soul.
Yes. And what does it mean for an American to be circulating in those waters?
Mm-hmm.
What's the role of a good American, as Captain Phillips is, meant to be for us? And I think it's no coincidence that he might have these many acts of bravery as an individual, but he's not the one who actually, wounds his captors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he's the one who actually has moments of trying to, talk them out of this situation so that everybody can survive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's others who come in and actually execute the deaths.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Christina Bross is an English professor at Purdue University and the author of the forthcoming book, Indies, East and West, Global Currents in 17th Century English Literature.
I'm Brian Bella.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Peter Onuf. Today, we're taking the show to the movies. We're looking at the way history is depicted in this year's Oscar nominees.
The based on true events film that's gotten the most buzz this year is, of course, 12 Years a Slave. In fact, the last time 12 Years a Slave was this popular was probably back in 1853, when Solomon Northup's story was first published as a book. It was a bestseller, in fact, on par with Frederick Douglass's autobiography. The book was so popular that even 10 years later, in the middle of the Civil War, one Union soldier used the story as a kind of map of Louisiana.
We are in the district that formed the theater of Solomon Northup's bondage.
This is a diary entry from May 19, 1863, read by University of New Orleans historian Mary Nile Mitchell. It refers to specific people from Northup's narrative, including Edwin Epps, the most brutal of his masters.
Plenty of Negroes are found about here who say that they knew Platt, which is Northup's name while he was enslaved, well, and have danced to the music of his fiddle often. Some who remember when he was taken out of the lot by Northern gentlemen.
One of those Northern gentlemen who helped free Solomon Northup was a white abolitionist named Henry Northup. He thought that Solomon ought to write a book about his experience. The book would illustrate the evils of slavery and might help build a legal case against his kidnappers.
Henry Northup enlisted a white lawyer and aspiring writer named David Wilson to interview Solomon and help craft the narrative. So Solomon Northup's autobiography, well, let's just say it wasn't literally written by Solomon Northup.
You might expect that a 19th century audience would be skeptical given this background. But Mary Mitchell told me that initially people read 12 Years a Slave as a factual narrative.
I don't think people were particularly skeptical of it at the time. I think even the local New Orleans paper ran a story about the account as a sort of straightforward account of what happened to a free man from New York.
Wow.
And Northrop did go to great lengths to provide facts that would verify his account, including names, places, things that often former slave narrators had to leave out if they were still fugitives. They used pseudonyms sometimes to avoid detection. But Northrop didn't have any of those problems. And so his main objective really was to convince his readers of the truth of his tale because he was an ex-slave narrator, but also because people might have considered it too extraordinary to be true.
And we should say that subsequent research has proven that almost all the detail is exactly right.
Absolutely.
Now, would people have been concerned that there was a white author, kind of ghostwriter, amanuensis involved in this?
That's an interesting question, too, because that was sort of common practice with these former slave narratives. People were more accustomed than not to seeing a white editor collaborating with a former slave to tell his or her story. But what's really interesting is that skepticism about these 19th century narratives really becomes more pronounced after the Civil War. And I think that's because of the context. The Civil War was being sort of re-scripted as a war between brothers, as a fight about differences in politics. But slavery was being written out of that memory of the Civil War. And nobody understood this better than Frederick Douglass, who lived a very long time and did his best to point this out, that slavery should not be forgotten as being at the root of that conflict. That's a large reason why I think these slave narratives fall out of print and become sort of suspicious documents in the view of a lot of people, including historians.
So how today do we sort of read documents such as the slave narratives that were written for a very instrumental purpose? I mean, they were written to shock people about the injustice of slavery. Does that mean that we should read them with our own kind of skepticism?
Absolutely. I think we have to think about audience, who they were trying to appeal to. Most of the people who would have read these narratives were largely northern middle-class people.
White people.
White people. And there are things that former slaves felt like they could reveal and things they couldn't reveal. Harriet Jacobs' narrative is a perfect example of this, where she's a woman who had been pursued sexually by her owner, and the mores of the day just made it very hard for her to explain her reality in a way that was palatable for middle-class audiences. So I think thinking about all those things, I think it's more helpful to think about the limitations on the slave narrator, to think about what were they able to communicate and how did they have to communicate it in order to reach a certain audience. And then doing that, you can sort of see the tightrope they were walking in terms of what they could and couldn't say about their experiences.
So what do you think of the film as somebody who knows the narrative so well?
I think, on the whole, I think it's great. I was very pleased with it. It's very difficult to watch, which means that he did a good job. Actually, there's another 19th century guy that went to Epps Plantation, and he says, he talks all about it and how he visited there, and he talked to people, and then he says, but Northrop didn't convey the true horror of it.
Wow.
Because nobody could. that the system was so terrifying and awful that words couldn't explain it. And yet, in Northrop's narrative, he really emphasizes the violence. So I think the movie definitely picks up on that and makes that kind of a central theme for people to understand the level of violence that was necessary to control enslaved people in the 19th century.
Mary Nile Mitchell is a historian at the University of New Orleans.
If you're just joining us, this is Backstory, and we're talking about the ways that Hollywood tackles history. We've gotten some great questions and comments on our website and have one of those commenters on the line with us now. It's Jeremy in Atlanta. Hey, Jeremy, what do you have for us?
Yeah, I was just wondering, I really enjoyed 12 Years a Slave, and I was wondering how historically accurate the Benedict Cumberbatch's kind of the, quote, good slave master was, if that was even possible under a large plantation system, or if that's just kind of a fictitious afterthought.
Jeremy, for those who haven't seen the film, what made this slaveholder a quote, good slaveholder?
Well, at least the ways portrayed in the movie is relatively speaking, you know, kinder and more empathetic or humane. I mean, all the harshness or roughness still happens, but it's always through intermediaries, and whenever he's around, everyone's kind of more polite. And
yeah, two things struck me. I mean, he allows Solomon to show some initiative, to use his intelligence and his experience to float logs down the river rather than drag them over the road. And the other thing is that the slave owner gives Solomon a violin. Solomon's a talented violinist. He gives him a violin of his own.
So Jeremy wants to know whether there was such a thing as a good slaveholder, and Ed has the answer. Is it yes or no, Ed?
The answer is yes, and the answer is even more than yes. If you did not have people who imagined that they were living to the highest standards of religious faith and of good Victorian behavior, the system that embraced 4 million enslaved people would not have been able to have sustained itself. Mm-hmm. For generations, sustaining something just on greed would have been very hard to have done. If you hadn't been able to go to church and hear a sermon telling you you were doing the right thing by being a slaveholder, that you were advancing Jesus' mission by spreading his gospel to people who otherwise would have been trapped in heathen Africa. So it's a paradoxical answer, but that I think that white Southerners had to have people who were good masters in order to believe that the whole system itself was not just sin.
Well, you know, one of the horrible things about slavery, of course, is the dehumanization of the enslaved people. They are property, and they are manipulated for the benefit of their owners. But the rational manipulation of property depends on predictability. It depends on canons of efficiency. It even depends on a measure of trust. A slave operation that depends constantly on coercive force, on the whip, is not going to be efficient. And slave owners know this. So this is a classic case of what we call in the biz enlightened self-interest. Enlightened self-interest that has a religious gloss, as Ed was suggesting, that there's a sense of stewardship and responsibility for the larger operation. Perfectly good people, people of good faith, can be part of such a system. And that's what's so horrible about it, is that what it does to everybody involved.
So the answer to your question is, it's easier for us to think of it as a kind of a gulag in which it's just brute force. And instead, what we see is that people were implicated in every facet of their characters. You read the ads for slaves. They say, you know, a smart boy who can play music and build a barn better than anybody. I mean, those are – they say that. And so, you know, it's not to their interest just to turn somebody of intelligence and skill into just somebody working in the fields. And that's the reason that if you go back and see, they put dollar amounts on these various kinds of skills.
Mm, sure.
And this, quote, good slave owner ends up selling Solomon to an owner who he knows is not a good slaveholder, and he does it because of the system. He does it, he says, because of his debt. He feels that he has no choice, even though he obviously knows that Solomon Northrop has been a free man at some point, or certainly deeply suspects it.
Jeremy, what do we got here?
Yeah, and what do you think, Jeremy?
I think I need to go back and watch the movie, and I think it adds complexities and depth of color that makes it a far more interesting story.
Well, that's what we do. Whenever things seem too simple to you, Jeremy, give us a call.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Now on to another film about history, one that depicts events a lot of us still remember. Dallas Buyers Club is the story of Ron Woodruff, depicted as a heterosexual man living with AIDS in the mid-1980s. At the time, the main drug used to treat AIDS, called AZT, was in clinical trials and not available commercially. It also could be extremely toxic, and so Woodruff went off to Mexico to obtain alternative treatments for himself and others like him. The Food and Drug Administration did not look kindly on this maneuver, nor did doctors back home.
This is my patient. You treating these people?
Oh, they're treating themselves.
With what?
Vitamins, peptide T.
These ad hoc black markets were called buyers clubs, and they were actually quite common. Mark King is a longtime AIDS activist in Atlanta who was diagnosed with HIV in 1985. We gave him a call to hear about his own experiences going down to Mexico to obtain drugs not available in the States.
I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and we would go to Tijuana where you could get medications that were not yet approved in the United States, and we would load up the trunk. And we'd have a nice party on the beach and rent a house and have a great time, all of us living with HIV. Every time we went back, we were missing one. You know, someone had died. Oh, so there was certainly an environment in which all the rules in terms of healthcare up to that point were gone. You couldn't believe what your doctor told you. He didn't know. There was not a pill that you could take for this malady that you had. And there was no assurance that things were going to get better. So we all lived in this kind of existential dread of just seeing nothingness ahead of us. And I think that I lived in that for a couple of years until I really was jolted into action, much like a lot of the activists at the time were, and certainly in the movie.
So, Mark, in the movie, it makes the drugs coming out of Mexico look very benign. Did you have any sense of anxiety about risks that might have been associated with them?
Well, it was a calculated risk. I mean, we were all dying, and there were no other solutions, you know, available to us. So, you know, we would do our research, and there was certainly a big kind of underground community of activists who were exchanging information. A lot of organizations were cropping up, giving us information on new drugs, and it created a culture in which it was driven by patient advocacy. It was driven by the people living with the virus. And sure, it was a calculated risk, but really, what did we have to lose?
Mark, in Dallas Buyers Club, some of the straight people in the movie, including the protagonist, Matthew McConaughey, who are homophobic to begin with, come around to having a great deal of empathy for those people suffering with AIDS. But in reality, didn't AIDS make those who lived alternative lifestyles, whether it was transgender, transsexual, homosexual, didn't it make them even more anathema?
Yes. You know, there were serious conversations from serious politicians about, you know, putting us away to an island or in camps somewhere. I used to say, if they give us Maui, we'll go. But there was serious conversation about that, and it made me feel like, oh my gosh, you know, maybe they're right. AIDS kind of, in a sick way, proved what I had always feared as a young gay person growing up, and that was, God doesn't love me. I am not worthy. I might be doing something wrong. And to have it realized 10 years later, living in Los Angeles, where suddenly this plague happens that appears to just be killing gay men. I mean, it was so disturbing that I actually started to believe the rhetoric because it was so awful.
And what turned that around for you, Mark?
I worked in an AIDS service organization, and we actually helped people die. That's what we trained volunteers to do, to simply be with people and hold their hands and let them know that they were worthy and that they were loved. And seeing people that were heterosexual or maybe were even conservative, to watch them swim against the tide and come into our offices and say, you know, all of this stuff is crap. I want to help. What can I do? To witness that, that's what gave me faith.
So I wonder what advice you would give for people as they go to see Dallas Buyers Club. What would you want them to be sort of alert to? What would you want them to be noticing in that film?
What really separates this movie from every other AIDS movie I've seen, I've probably seen them all, is how AIDS is represented physically. You look at Matthew McConaughey, and it's not just the weight loss. It's the blotchy skin. It's the way he moves. It's the way the other people with AIDS moves. I haven't seen such a naturalistic portrayal of living with AIDS ever on screen. I would point out that the one thing that they do get wrong is in Dallas Buyers Club, they kind of personify the Food and Drug Administration in one man. And he always keeps popping up at the right time, you know, telling Matthew McConaughey to stop bringing things in from Mexico or that he can't be selling these particular items into his buyer's club. And it's a real oversimplification of the FDA's role. They're kind of characterized as the villain in this movie. And although it is true that they were villainous in the early years of AIDS and it took a lot of social activism to convince them to approve drugs more quickly and to establish clinical trials. But once they did, they really turned things around, and they should be accredited for the changes they made and for the partnership they created between themselves and activists.
That's Mark King. He blogs about his experience with HIV at myfabulousdisease.com.
It's time for a short break, but don't go away. When we get back, why America likes to be swindled. We're going to look at the history behind American Hustle and the Wolf of Wall Street.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Backstory. I'm Brian Ballow.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Peter Onuf. Today on the show, we're looking at history and the films that won those little golden statues.
In a recent article in The New Yorker, financial columnist James Surowiecki noticed that two of this year's Best Picture nominees featured charismatic con men. American Hustle tells the story of Irving Rosenfeld, a hustler caught up in a federal entrapment scheme. And Wolf of Wall Street depicts the rise and fall of conniving stockbroker Jordan Belfort.
Surowiecki argues that Americans have had a soft spot for swindlers throughout our long pop culture history. And few things, he says, are valued more in America than an entrepreneurial spirit. It's a spirit, says Surowiecki, on display early on in a scene from Wolf of Wall Street.
The first part of the film, which is when you see Jordan Belfort really doing his conning, is actually, in some ways, for me at least, the most engaging part of the film.
Yes.
And there's a great scene where he walks into the a penny stock brokerage for the first time. And you see him, you know, the guy basically gives him the phone and lets him cold call somebody. And you actually see him sell this penny stock and really sell it.
Well, reason for the call today, John, is something just came across my desk, John. It is perhaps the best thing I've seen in the last 6 months. If you have 60 seconds, I'd like to share the idea with you. You got a minute?
And the other kind of schmoes who are sitting there in the office and who have been trying to sort of lackadaisically sort of sell this stuff over the phone are kind of mesmerized by him.
How'd you f***ing do that?
You actually kind of really admire on some level, or at least are hypnotized by, his ability to actually really sell. It's a real skill, and you can see it. And there's something quite powerful about that.
As the son of a salesperson, I was stopped in my tracks by that scene, like all the schmoes sitting around listening to him. I'd like you to talk about, you claim that there's a fascination throughout the 20th century, and I was wondering if you could set the stage for us historically. When did Americans become fascinated with con men?
Well, the emergence of the phrase, the confidence man, dates back to the 1840s, it seems. As the story goes, a man named William Thompson, in some accounts his name is Samuel Williams, in any case, walked up to a stranger in Manhattan and sort of began chatting with him. And the person he was talking to felt like he knew the guy, but he wasn't sure exactly who he was. And the con man kept talking to him and then said somewhat mysteriously in retrospect, have you confidence in me to trust me with your watch until tomorrow? And the Mark, the stranger, basically ended up giving this guy his watch. And of course, the man disappeared and the Mark never saw his watch again. So after these first stories about William Thompson and the idea of the confidence man run in the newspapers, what happens is that the idea of the confidence man, I think pretty quickly, gains a hold on the American imagination. And really that persists all through the late 19th century and then really into the 20th century when it becomes a sort of staple of American popular culture.
Let's trace that fascination through films.
Well, you can go all the way back, I think, really to the 1930s. The Lady Eve, the great Preston Sturges film with Barbara Stanwyck. And then, you know, if you go on into the 1950s, I mean, you could The Music Man is a con man. How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying is kind of about using a certain kind of, you know, chicanery or at least playing the angles in order to get ahead. And then in the 1970s, obviously the most famous representation of con man in film is The Sting. You know, Paul Newman and Robert Redford as wonderful con men. I mean, what could be a greater representation of the con man as hero than them?
James, you've watched a lot of films about con men, which I might add should make your readers wonder about the veracity of your columns. But that's for another show. Tell us whether the figure of the con man or con person has changed over a century of films, for instance.
You know, it's a fascinating question because the answer you want to give is yes, that there's a kind of complex evolution of the con man. And I could argue that there has been. There are certainly darker portrayals of con men in films in the last, let's say, 25 years, if you think about, say, the work of David Mamet. At the same time, I would say that the fascination and, again, kind of admiration for the skill of the con men is something that really has persisted, I would argue. Mamet's films in particular, I think, are this really complex blend of not disdain, but certainly an awareness of the kind of darkness at the heart of the con man's efforts, which I think for Mamet, at least at the time, was also about the darkness at the heart of American capitalism. But then when you come to a movie like American Hustle, I do think that there is something quite striking about Christian Bale's character in American Hustle, that there really is something incredibly, you know, endearing and sweet about him. And I think it's a quite striking representation of the con artist.
So I want to ask you whether you think Americans are particularly fascinated by con men.
My argument would be yes. I mean, there are obviously representations of swindlers in every culture. But I do think America is particularly enamored of con men. I think there are a few reasons for that. I think that salesmanship has really been integral to America in a way that it I think arguably has not been as important in other cultures. I think really from the start, America was a country, I would say sort of built on, it sounds like kind of an odd phrase, but they say sort of built on the come. So it's sort of all about, it was historically all about the future. And there was an element of speculation, an element of hustling that was really integral to the growth of America, obviously in very literal ways. I mean, it was all about being able to move west. It was about kind of pioneering.
It was about getting people to come here, which was a bit of a hustle in and of itself, given the conditions.
Absolutely. I mean, it was all about the promise of something that was maybe not a reality yet. And it was all about convincing people that, you know, just over the next hill, there was something amazing. And sometimes there was and sometimes there wasn't.
So at the essence, are you saying that capitalism has a bit of a con at its core?
Yeah. And I think this is another reason why Americans are so fond in some ways of con men. And that is to say that the capitalism and in particular entrepreneurial capitalism, you know, really depends on selling the dream of a future that no one really knows whether or not it's going to come true. You know, if you're starting a business and you are trying to expand and you're trying to raise money, you're really sort of pitching a dream. And the obvious difference between the con man and the entrepreneur is the con man knows that the dream can't come true. But in both cases, they really are sort of selling hope.
But in both cases, don't you need dreamers? Isn't that the key?
Yeah, I think that's really right, that you need people who are really willing to put up a lot of money in the hope that it's going to give them a lot more money somewhere down the road. And I think that, again, the con game is that hope kind of extended to its logical and ultimately, in this case, sort of false extreme.
James, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And I wonder if before you go, you could just let me hold your watch for a day.
Yeah, exactly. Here, I'm glad to give you my confidence, Brian.
Thanks for joining us on Backstory.
Thanks for having me on.
James Surowiecki is a financial columnist at The New Yorker. We'll link to his article, Do the Hustle, on our website, backstoryradio.org. Peter, Ed, we've been hearing from a lot of thoughtful people about a lot of thoughtful movies. Now it's time for us to weigh in.
And there goes the thoughtfulness, I'm sorry to say.
Now, the basic idea behind the Academy Awards is that the people who make up the film industry are best equipped to judge the merits of particular films. And so you have actors making the best actor nomination, cinematographers making the best cinematography nomination, and so forth and so on. In that spirit, we decided to inject our own expertise as historians into the mix this year and come up with a short list of Oscar-nominated films that we think do the best job of dealing with a historical subject.
And here are the criteria. Number one, the movie must look right, but it's got to be more than just a costume drama.
Right.
The characters
right.
must be fully embedded in their time and place.
Yep. Gotcha. Yep. Yeah.
Number two, we know from Backstory that history is always complicated, but a history winner must compress that complexity into a story that seems truthful,
right.
a story
yeah.
that could be true according to everything we know about the time and place.
Yeah, true
okay?
enough.
Mm-hmm. And then number three, the film must engage a big question that still matters today and help viewers rethink what they thought the answers to that question was.
Gotcha.
So, without much further ado, it is time to present our nominations for the first annual HISTY Award. And Peter, you get to go first. What do you got for us?
Well, what I got for you is Dallas Buyers Club. And I'll tell you why.
Ah.
We have lived history, but our memories are selective. And this is a way of re-immersing ourselves in a time that we don't really have immediately accessible
right.
to us. And
it's the Bermuda Triangle of history.
Exactly. And the
right,
AIDS
right,
plague and epidemic was one of the great moments in the history of American public health risks that affected so many Americans, was so powerful, and so many screaming headlines. But did we get inside it? Unless we actually lived it, do we understand it? No, and I think
– So, Peter, distill it.
Okay,
What is it that really merits the HISTY?
I'll tell you what it is.
One sentence.
It is the look of the film, including the looks on people's faces, the damage they suffer. It makes it compelling and powerful. And I'll tell you, we don't see these. This is kind of authenticity that's not available to us. It's something that we don't do as historians.
Peter – that was a really good case you made. I'm going to go next, Ed, because I just got to jump on this authenticity thing. So I've picked a film that can't possibly be authentic. I've picked Her. It can't be authentic because Her...
it's not even history!
Exactly. I want to shake things up. Her's a film that is set in the near future. It's about a guy, Theodore, who falls in love with his iPhone, in essence, the operating system, and they have a love affair. Why do I think it merits a HISTY? Well, one of those criteria we talked about was shedding light on a really big question. And I think by going into the future, Her sheds light on individualism out of control. Now, it won't surprise my history friends here that individualism is very much the story of American history. Going back to John Locke and inalienable rights, in the 20th century, we push individualism by – we move from the Model T, for instance, to cars that come in different colors and different shapes to appeal to different individuals in consumer society. Well, in her, that individualism is pushed over the edge into outright narcissism. What makes for a perfect relationship? It's the ability of your operating system, your computer, to anticipate every individual need that you have.
So Brian, up until now, there's been a kind of technophobia, a fear that we'll be reduced to the machine will control us. But that's being flipped now, and you think that casts a fresh light?
It's flipped. I'm not going to give away the ending. Right. It is flipped. Let's just say the machine is the good guy. I will say I think it deserves possible consideration for the Histy Award.
Well, guys, that's pretty good. I have to admit that I'm loaded for bear here. It's really don't really have any great sense of challenge because I think it's obvious that the real Histy has to go to 12 Years a Slave this year. One of the great films about American slavery, which is a very short list. And the film is brave on any number of levels. Now, we're used to violence now, and there is an enormous amount of violence in this film. We're used to injustice, and there's an enormous amount of that. What we're not used to is a movie doesn't have a plot in which it's just one scene after another.
Yeah, I never thought of that. You're right.
Yeah. Well, and to have it just sort of mimic the experience of slavery, which is completely out of control of the fundamental circumstances of your life. Now, like Peter in the Dallas Buyers Club, this movie looks right.
Yeah, I think that's
and
right.
And I just want to point out, I've seen both films, and in both films, I ended up identifying with somebody who seemed, you know, about as far removed from my world as imaginable. Either this homophobic guy dying of AIDS, possibly, or the slave in 19th century, which I knew very little about.
Yeah, and the filmmaker doesn't actually pander to us in that regard, Brian. You're right. You develop that sense of affinity, but not because they are pulling at your heartstrings.
Yeah, and I did think 12 Years was very powerful, but in some ways it seemed almost too powerful, and we're responding to what you might call the pornography of violence. And yeah, there's some titillation and thrills in this, but does it accurately represent the quotidian day-to-day experience in the life of a slave?
Well, you know, I think this raises some of the same issues that people have when they try to represent the Holocaust. Yeah, how do you blend in any sense of how people survived with a portrayal of the violence and injustice they endured? But I thought the very fact that it was not building toward anything, there's very little redemption. I mean, the people who suffer this just suffer it. Mm-hmm. And Solomon Northrop himself has to inflict some of the violence. So I think you're right, Peter, that people need to know this is a profoundly uncomfortable film, precisely because, not because it shows so much violence, Django Unchained showed more violence.
That's right.
But rather because it shows unredemptive violence.
And Ed, remember one of those criteria we talked about, films have a remarkable capacity to compress effectively. And I think inevitably in compressing a story, you're going to run into the criticism that Peter leveled.
Yeah. And we historians have a remarkable capacity for making things boring by including too much detail that doesn't really have a compelling truth to convey.
Well, that's something I envy the films for. They can convey all this detail and make it a faster way of telling the story. You just look at a slave cabin. Think how long it would take us to describe that.
And I think really a good historical film is humbling for historians because this is something beyond our powers and it's something we deeply respect. And if we seem critical about most shows that play with history, it doesn't mean we don't appreciate the power of history rendered in a meaningful way that only movies can render it.
I'm going to Hollywood City where the stars are pretty as a palm swaying in the breeze. And when I get to the city where the stars are pretty, I'll live a life of ease, gonna buy me some clothes.
Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Tony Field, Jess Ingebretson, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, and Jesse Dukes. Emily Charnock is our research and web coordinator, and Jamal Milner is our engineer. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. Additional funding is provided by Weinstein Properties and History Channel. History made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.